Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Dispatch 16. Thanks for joining me. As always, I'd like to start by thanking you guys for your support. Without your help, none of this would be possible. Anyway, we have some good questions this month, so let's dive in. First, Roy Park asked, I had noticed you always refer to the death of the Duke of Enghien as a murder and not an execution. How intentional is this? This is intentional. I try not to put my personal politics into the show, but I do think that when we're talking about serious and still relevant subjects like capital punishment, it's important to be accurate. To me, execution implies that a killing was legal, that a person was adjudicated guilty by some kind of above-board legal process, and that a death sentence was carried out according to some kind of proper standard. Execution was perfectly legal in Napoleonic France. Whatever your personal feelings on the morality of capital punishment, the fact is most executions carried out in the country under Napoleon's government were carried out according to the letter of the law. That is not true of the killing of the Duke of Enghien. As you might recall from our episode on his death, he was never legally arrested, but abducted from a foreign country. The way I see it, anything the French government did to him after that moment was unlawful. And even if he had been properly arrested, the legality of his trial is questionable as well. Matters of jurisdiction, and even the very constitutionality of the special treason tribunals. His arrest was quite clearly and unambiguously illegal. Whether or not the court that tried him actually had the right to try him is also questionable. The trial itself is a bit murkier. It had some elements of a proper legal proceeding, but some elements of an unfair kangaroo court. The Duke was denied outside legal counsel, had little opportunity to study or answer the charges against him, and had no right of appeal. There is a mitigating factor here. The Duke was guilty. Not of all the tribunal's charges, but he had betrayed his country and gone to work for the British. This was provable beyond any shadow of a doubt, and he admitted to it. Even today, in many countries that have banned capital punishment for ordinary civilian crimes, treason during wartime is still punishable by death. However, we shouldn't judge trials based on how much the accused may or may not deserve to be punished. We should judge them on how fair they are and how closely they hew to the law. Given all the irregularities around the trial and illegal shortcuts taken by the Napoleonic government in this case, I think it's appropriate to call the Duke's death a murder. An illegal killing by a government is one of the worst abuses of power imaginable. I try to avoid using this platform to get on my high horse and preach, but this type of quasi-legal state murder is sadly not a thing of the past. So I do think it's important to talk about it frankly and condemn it, even in a case that's over 200 years old. Next, JCraft59 asked, I could have missed this conversation, but have you ever talked about the card or board games soldiers played in their free time? How did those games differ from the officers? Did they follow along class lines? I remember seeing that there were different decks of cards. I can't recall the dates they evolved, with a French set of 32 cards, while other decks evolved to 52. Was whist played often? Generally, when we talk about games played in the armies and navies of this era, we're talking about gambling. Gambling was almost ubiquitous in Europe during this period, in basically every country and every class. That was even more true in the armed forces. In fact, gambling was so common in the military that it was often considered notable when a military man of this era did not gamble. For instance, many biographies of Lord Nelson make note of the fact that he did not partake. Board games, as we know them, didn't really take off until much later in the 19th century. Of course, chess existed and was played widely. Many modern chess variants had yet to be invented, but the rules of the basic game were the same as they are today. If you know how to play standard chess and could somehow time travel back to the Napoleonic era, you would have no trouble playing a game. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Bonaparte himself was a chess player, and there are records of some of his games, but apparently many of them are spurious, so use your discretion if you go looking for them. Checkers existed as well, or drafts, as it is known in some places. But there was no real standard game. There were many variations on the rules and different board sizes and numbers of pieces. The same is true of backgammon. In fact, backgammon was just one of a whole genre of similar games, referred to as table games. You might say, I was playing tables, in the same way a person today might say, I was playing cards. Board games were played in the armies of the Napoleonic Wars, but it seems card and dice games were far more popular. I assume this has something to do with the fact that a deck of playing cards or a pair of dice are far more portable. Just like with board games, there was a huge variety in the card games played by Napoleonic soldiers. Not only were there many different games with almost endless variations on the rules, there were many different types of card decks. Many of these differences were regional or national. They could even be political. During the height of the Revolution, the royal-themed Jack, Queen, and King were replaced by the revolutionary Genius, Liberty, and Equality. The card decks we are most familiar with today are 52 cards with 4 suits, hearts, diamonds, clubs, and spades, with numbered cards going from 2 to 10, Jacks, Queens, and Kings as the face cards, and aces either at the top or bottom of the hierarchy, depending on the game. In Napoleonic times, this style was referred to as a French deck. By this period, the French deck was more or less standard in France and French-influenced parts of Europe, as well as in Britain, Ireland, and the USA. However, these 52-card decks could be truncated for specific games. For instance, the most popular card game within the Grande Armée was a bridge-like game called Piquet, which is played with only 32 cards. So players would have to either go through the deck and remove every card below a 7 before starting, or play with a specialized Piquet deck. There were many other types of decks that were popular in other parts of Europe. For instance, traditional South German playing cards come in decks of 36. And the suits are acorns, leaves, hearts, and bells. Spanish decks had 48 cards, with swords, clubs, cups, and coins as the 4 suits, and a card called the Cavalier replacing the Queen. On top of the regional differences, there were specialized decks that were designed for specific games, and sub-regional varieties that differed slightly from the prevailing style. For instance, Swiss card decks typically resembled South German playing cards, but with different suits. With all this variety, it's hard to generalize about what games were popular among the troops. Consensus seems to be that Piquet was most popular among French soldiers, but within the Grande Armée, you might find ethnic Germans playing Schafkopf. Swiss soldiers might play a similar but unrelated game called Yas. Many of the most popular games were variants of Tarot, the first real popular European card game, which had its heyday in the late Middle Ages and Renaissance. These descendants of tarot are usually classified as trick-taking games, where each player is dealt a hand of cards that they play strategically in sequences called tricks, with the goal of winning the trick and thus scoring points and/or winning the money staked on each sequence. Trick-taking games are still hugely popular today. I would guess many of you listening have at least some familiarity with one of the modern incarnations, like hearts, spades, or bridge. None of those games had been invented yet, but they all evolved from games that were being played in this period that had similar rules. You mentioned whist in your question. If you've never heard of whist, for starters, you should really read Around the World in 80 Days by Jules Verne, which is a great book whose protagonist is a master of whist. Whist was invented in the mid-18th century, and was definitely played during the Napoleonic Wars, primarily by the British, which is where the game originated. But it was still comparatively new, and wouldn't reach the apex of its popularity until much later in the 19th century. Modern bridge is actually a version of whist. A variant to the rules emerged at the end of the 19th century, which was called bridge whist, which was eventually shortened to just bridge. The most popular card game in modern America, poker, was probably invented either during the Napoleonic era or just before it. But by this stage in history, it was just an American regional game played along the southern Mississippi. Maybe a few American soldiers and militiamen who hailed from the southern frontier were playing poker during the War of 1812, but it would have been practically unknown in Europe. However, some of the earlier games upon which poker was probably based were still being played in Europe. There was a Spanish game called Hombre, a French game called Bouillotte, and an English game called Brag. I've actually played Brag, and it's definitely not poker, but there are similarities. The dice game Craps was probably invented around this time as well, but it is an American game, and to this day has never attained popularity in Europe. However, similar games were played in Europe during this period, just like with cards, usually with national and regional variations. There was also a genre of dice games similar to modern Yahtzee, Generala in Spain, Kniffle in Germany, and Yahtzee-Tahtzee in Poland, which is where the Milton Bradley Company got the name for their version of the game. There was a dice game popular within the Royal Navy called Crown and Anchor, which is still played today, and still associated with British sailors. It uses special dice, with graphics of a crown, anchor, and the four card suits on each side of the dice, rather than the numerical dots we are more familiar with. Dominoes was just beginning to take off in Europe in the late 18th century. According to one story, the game was first introduced to England by French prisoners, captured during the War of the First Coalition. However, in this era, dominoes were usually made of heavy materials, and thus were not very practical to take on campaign. Amazingly, on some campaigns, French officers and soldiers would have had the option of playing roulette. Apparently, the train of merchants, moneylenders, and war profiteers that followed the Grande Armée sometimes included mobile casinos, which featured roulette. So, in short, there would have been an absolutely huge variety of games played by Napoleonic officers and soldiers. As we'll see in future episodes, by the latter stages of the Napoleonic Wars, many of these armies were very multi-ethnic and multinational. The soldiers would have brought games from their home countries and regions with them, and perhaps taught them to some of their comrades. Despite this huge variety, there was a common denominator to almost all these games. They could be played for money, and usually were. Gambling was a huge part of military culture in this era, to the point where behavior that today would probably be considered pathological was more or less normal, and even celebrated. We've talked in past episodes about the cult of daring in the Napoleonic armies. This was an era in which audacity and the willingness to face danger could mean the difference between victory and defeat, or life and death. I think gambling was a part of this. How could a man who wasn't even brave enough to risk his salary at the tables be expected to risk his life on the battlefield? By joining the army, these men had already staked their lives. What was the harm in throwing a little coin into the pot as well? These men were surrounded by death. Veterans often wrote of an eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we die attitude within the ranks. And of course, we're talking about a large concentration of young men, far from home, mostly heavy drinkers, being supervised by other unattached, hard-drinking young men. This is the type of environment where you would expect risky behavior. Wealthier officers of this period sometimes lost fortunes. Shortly after the Allied victory at Waterloo, the great Prussian field marshal Gebhard Leibrecht von Blücher apparently lost 1.5 million francs in one night in a Paris casino, worth roughly $12 million in today's money. After what had happened on that muddy plain north of Brussels only a few months earlier, perhaps we can't blame him for believing Lady Luck was on his side. Then again, according to some sources, he actually dug himself out of this hole and left Paris a winner, so maybe he really was blessed by fortune. Prince Pyotr Bagration, an extremely capable Russian general we've met in several past episodes, was a notorious gambler. He was forced to sell off many of his family's considerable estates, and even some of his personal possessions, to cover his gambling losses. The great French hussar general Antoine de La Salle was a man who did everything to absolute maximum intensity, including gambling. At one point, he was so deep in the hole that Napoleon himself got involved, and actually paid off La Salle's creditors from his own personal funds. Next, Priag asked, what was Napoleon and France's relationship like with the Marathas and other Indian states during this time period? While Napoleon was conquering Europe, Britain was consolidating control over massive swathes of the Indian subcontinent. Were the other great powers noticing this, or were they too distracted? If you end up doing a multi-episode deep dive on the Duke of Wellington, do you plan to cover his early career as a sepoy soldier at all? As you mention in your question, the Napoleonic era overlaps with a pivotal period of Indian history. European powers had been making inroads into the region for over a century, but it was in the generation just before the French Revolution that the British emerged as the dominant political, military, and economic power in India. By the time of Napoleon's rise, the British were more or less in control over maybe a fifth of India's territory, exerted indirect control over many minor Indian states, and were working hard to expand their influence even further by diplomacy, military conquest, and economic domination. For decades, Europeans had been aware that India was a source of almost unimaginable wealth. The other great powers looked on with dread, and presumably jealousy, as they watched British influence wash over the subcontinent. But there was little they could do. Quite simply, the reason the British had outclassed all their European competitors in the region was that they were far better at projecting power into India. There was not a whole lot of direct contact between Indian states and France during the Napoleonic era. Quite simply, India and France are very far apart, and with the Royal Navy enjoying a huge advantage at sea, any links between France and points overseas were tenuous at best. The French did have colonies in the area, including a handful of small but significant outposts on the Indian mainland, most notably the city of Pondicherry. These would actually remain French up until the 1950s. However, the British captured them relatively quickly and easily during the War of the First Coalition, and they were not returned to France until after Napoleon's defeat, so these colonies were not a factor during this period. If you'll think back to our episodes on the expedition to Egypt, this was part of the rationale behind the decision to invade. Egypt was an important waypoint on the route to India, and it was hoped that once Bonaparte established himself in the country, he would be able to link up with Indian states resisting the British, and provide them with money, arms, and maybe even direct military support. Some preliminary attempts were made, but as we know, the French position in Egypt deteriorated pretty quickly, and soon the expedition was too focused on survival to pay much attention to such grandiose plans. Many of these hopes were focused on the Kingdom of Mysore, led by Tipu Sultan, commonly known as the Tiger of Mysore, a very capable ruler and competent military leader. Mysore had a large army, which was very professional, well-trained, and technologically advanced, and Tipu was fanatically opposed to the British. Mysore and France had a good relationship, going all the way back to the old regime. Part of the reason Tipu's army was so modern was that he had invited French advisors to help him build it, which the French had been happy to provide, as a counter on British influence in the region. As they say, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. According to some sources, Tipu Sultan even allowed his French guests to form a Jacobin club in Mysore after the revolution, although this may be apocryphal. After his conquest of Egypt, Napoleon actually wrote a letter to Tipu Sultan, quote, "To the most magnificent Sultan, our greatest friend, Tipu Sahib. You have already been informed of my arrival on the shores of the Red Sea, with an innumerable and invincible army, full of the desire of delivering you from the iron yoke of England. I eagerly embrace this opportunity of testifying to you the desire that I have of being informed by you, by way of Muscat and Mocha, as to your political situation. I would even wish you to send some intelligent person who has your confidence to Suez or Cairo, with whom I might confer. May the Almighty increase your power and destroy your enemies. Signed, Bonaparte." Unfortunately for both parties, the letter was intercepted by the British, and according to some sources, it helped motivate the British to attack Mysore once again. Mysore did prove to be a major thorn in the side of British India, but French support for Tipu's war effort was sporadic at best, and the Tiger of Mysore died in early 1799. Fittingly, he fell right in the thick of the fighting as the British stormed his capital. There was, of course, the overland route to India, through Russia, a host of mostly small and weak Central Asian states, and modern-day Afghanistan. After the Treaty of Tilsit made France and Russia allies, this route was theoretically open to the French. According to some sources, Napoleon and Alexander actually did discuss an overland invasion of British India. It would have been an incredible undertaking, and it's fascinating to contemplate, but the idea went nowhere. To get to the last part of your question, I was planning on doing exactly that, using Wellington's early career in India as a jumping-off point to talk about what was going on the subcontinent during this period. But the more I thought about it, the less I liked the idea. Wellington's time in India is important to his development as a military commander, but he did not actually spend much time in the region. An episode on India structured around Wellington would be a long introduction explaining all the context before he arrived, a very short part in the middle that actually featured the man himself, and then a long postscript explaining what happened in the nearly two decades between Wellington's departure and the end of our story. It's not a good structure. I'm looking for other avenues to approach this story. Next, Adam H. asked, was it possible to send mail to soldiers in the Grande Armée? If so, how would you address it, and how would it get there? Amazingly, there was regular mail service between France and the camps of the Grande Armée. This was handled by the Military Postal Service, which was a sub-branch of the regular National Civilian Postal Service. Letters would be addressed to the soldier by name, and then to his unit, rather than a physical address. The letters traveled by the same system of relay posts which we discussed in an earlier dispatch, the same routes used to disseminate messages between military units and between the headquarters and Paris. Mail from home was delivered to the baggage master of each unit, who was then responsible for distributing it or informing soldiers with mail to come pick it up. Every unit on campaign had a mailbox in camp, kept next to the flag to make it easy to find. It cost 15 centimes to mail a letter. This was raised to 25 centimes in 1810. That was actually pretty pricey. Base pay for a simple line infantryman was only 30 centimes a day, and a lot of that was deducted by the army to pay for various expenses. So they typically got only about 5 centimes a day in actual pocket money. So, an average private in a fusilier company in 1810 would have had to save his pocket money for 5 days just to mail one letter. If a soldier couldn't afford that, they were allowed to send letters postage due, meaning the recipient would have to pay to receive the letter. It was even possible to send money home from the front, for a 5% service fee. Apparently, it took about 2 weeks for the Military Postal Service to get a letter from France to Eastern Germany. Presumably, it took a bit longer for soldiers further afield, and less time for those closer to home. It is a pretty remarkable service, given the technological and organizational limitations of the time. No wonder it was a bit expensive. A similar system existed in the British forces. As far as I can tell, France and Britain were the only major countries of this period with dedicated military mail services. Soldiers and sailors of other countries had to either chance the civilian postal service of whatever country they were serving in, or give their letters to someone who was on their way home. According to one source, during the negotiations at Tilsit, King Frederick William of Prussia inquired to a French officer about the mailbox in his regiment's camp. When the officer explained the French army's mail service to him, the king was impressed, saying, quote, "It is admirable. Certainly, gentlemen, it is impossible to make finer camps than yours, but you must admit that you make ugly villages." End quote. Whatever that means. This discussion of mail reminds me of one of my favorite anecdotes from the memoirs of Captain Elzéar Blas, that somewhat cynical and sarcastic cavalry officer I've quoted from in several past dispatches. Quote, "When we arrived at a lodging, officer, sub-lieutenant, or private, everyone thought of paying court to the lady or daughter of the house. This often served no purpose. Sometimes they were successful. In any case, it was good to keep in practice. My captain was married, but he willingly forgot it. I have known many officers who, under certain circumstances, had no better memories. In all these lodgings, they passed themselves off as bachelors, If they saw a young girl, they immediately became romantic, spoke of marriage, and occasionally they were listened to. Marriage. You know this is a magic word for a maiden. A man for whom she would not deign to look upon as a man, she considers with goodwill as soon as she believes him susceptible to making a husband. A husband. It is a great affair. Every day this sweet word comes into the mind of young women. As a kaleidoscope, their imagination makes them take on all forms. They build upon the subject many castles in the air, and Lord knows how often they are disappointed. However that may be, my captain caused himself to be listened to by means of this little untruth. And I, who almost had a proposal ready, but did not possess the face of a marrying man, was frequently repulsed with loss, although I was 20 years younger than my rival. The respect of which I have always made profession in favor of good morals, conjugal fidelity, and perhaps a bit of jealousy, made me contrive a means of supplanting him. As soon as my captain began to play the gallant, "Captain," I said to him out loud, "the baggage master has just arrived. I believe that he has a letter from your wife." "Keep quiet," he would whisper. But I pretended not to understand, and continued bravely, "Napoleon, your oldest son," all officers' sons were named Napoleon, "must be big. He must be progressing. He is a very intelligent boy. Is he still at the Antwerp College?" "What is that to you?" And little Hortense, all officers' daughters were called Hortense, later they took the name Marie-Louise, "is little Hortense as mischievous as ever?" "That will do. That's enough. It's none of your business." "By my faith, it is mighty fine to be married, to have children. One sees oneself again as one used to be. This bachelor's life is often very dull, and I have never been so inclined to abandon it as I am today." Immediately the young lady's answers to the captain became cooler. Soon she no longer looked at him. He was married, and consequently he was a useless being. All the ground he lost I gradually gained, and sometimes I have profited by these indiscretions. End quote. So just imagine, where would poor Elzaïar Blas's love life have been without this remarkable mail service? That's all for now. I'll be back to you soon with more from the main narrative. As always, thank you for your support, and thanks for listening.